This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast. Best bits from March the 19th. It was a Tuesday morning. Much anticipation about what was or might be happening on the markets. So we kept a close eye on those markets as we waited to see what interest rate decisions would be made down in Australia and Japan. In fact, that information coming through live whilst we were on air. So we had reaction to that one from, in fact, we were crossed down live to Australia, spoke to Josh Gilbert of eToro, but also got the thoughts of Khatija Haque right here in the UAE about what those impacts of international rates might have on the market here. So a big focus on the markets for us. In fact, there was a big focus on all sorts of markets throughout the show this morning. We also focused on the energy market. Sean Evers was in studio with us. He's the founder and the managing partner of Gulf Intelligence. He was in to talk about oil price. Oil price going north. It's in good territory at the moment. Seems to have broken out the shackles of that 79 to 82 mark. But equally, big conference taking place in Houston at the moment. Some rather interesting comments coming out of that conference and a big deal out of Abu Dhabi in the last few days. So a lot for us to get our teeth into with Sean. And then just rates is all about the rates, because we also had Taimer Khan in. He's the head of research, MENA, at CBRE. We were talking about, well, real estate rates, if you like. Obviously, the property market, real estate booming here at the moment. But it seems now that a number of property developers and property companies are casting their eyes further afield. Seems to be something of a trend developing at the moment of property companies either buying or working with different geographies around the world. So we've obviously looked at that in some detail, asked if there was something developing there with Taimer from CBRE. That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast, only on Dubai Eye 103.8. We are on something of a rates watch this morning. We've got our very own rating agency over in the corner there. Richard Dean has set up. He's keeping an eye on international markets, left, right and centre. And a couple are delivering, albeit not the sort of big numbers one might be expecting.
Yeah, so the biggie was Japan this morning. Would they raise interest rates for the first time in 17 years? And the answer was yes, they did. This is widely anticipated. The Nikkei media outlet in Tokyo said that the central bank has been laying the foundations among market participants for the past 48 hours or so. And they've done it. It's symbolic, of course. Interest rates are now between 0 and 0.1%. But for Japan, after 17 years, nearly two decades of accommodative policy, they are now back in positive territory. In Australia, the central bank kept rates on hold. That was a bit more of a knife edge. There were those who thought that Australia would cut. 4.35% is quite tight. Inflation is coming down. It's still 4%-ish, but they thought they might cut them to give the economy a boost. They didn't. There were some hawks who thought with inflation at 4%, they might even hike rates again, but that didn't happen. We're waiting for the commentary from Michelle Bullock, who's the governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. But the message in the statement was that no, interest, inflation is still too high, so we're not cutting rates. We are going to get reaction to this in about 10 minutes' time. I'm going to cross live to Sydney, actually. Josh Gilbert is an analyst with eToro. He's watching not just the statement and what people are saying. He's also watching the market reaction to that as well. So he's joining us live, yeah, around about 15 minutes' time.
Let's get the thoughts of a regular on the show, Khatija Haque, Chief Economist for Emirates NBD. Khatija's been asked for her thoughts on these interest rate watches at the moment. Let's get the first on Australia.
The Reserve Bank of Australia opted to keep rates on hold today as expected at 4.35%. And they also seem more confident that inflation is moving in the right direction. However, the bank has not ruled out further rate hikes and have said that they're keeping all options open. Inflation has slowed in Australia, but services inflation remains quite high, and wage growth also accelerated in the last quarter of 2023. The futures market is currently pricing just one rate cut by the RBA this year, and that would happen potentially in September.
That's what the Aussies did. What about the Japanese?
The Bank of Japan has raised its policy rate at today's meeting to 0% from minus 0.1% previously in a move that was seemingly signaled to local press overnight. Most analysts had expected the shift to normalizing monetary policy only in April. The Bank of Japan has said it will keep buying government bonds in roughly the same amounts as before, but it will no longer be buying equity ETFs or real estate investment trusts. This is the first rate hike from the Bank of Japan since 2007 and marks a shift away from the very unconventional monetary policy easing that has been in place since then. The BOJ is the last central bank to move away from negative interest rates. They have offered very little in the way of forward guidance and simply said that they will monitor economic and financial market developments going forward.
So the age-old question, what could it mean for us here in the UAE?
There is little direct impact on the UAE from the Bank of Japan's decision to start normalizing policy, but there will most likely be an impact on US Treasury yields as some Japanese investors will shift assets out of the US and back to Japan. There will likely be volatility in Treasuries as well as other liquid bond markets such as the Eurozone when they open later today. But it's too early, really, to see the full impact of this change in monetary policy.
The thoughts of Khatija Haque, the chief economist, Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Yeah, live in Sydney, joining us now is from the trading floor of eToro, the brokerage. It's a real pleasure to have Josh Gilbert, market analyst. Morning, Josh.
Morning, Richard.
Let's start with Australia. So keeping rates on hold. Most economists predicted that, but there were some outliers. What was your reaction?
Yeah, as you say, pretty unsurprising today from the Reserve Bank, keeping rates on sort of hold. A slight sort of shift maybe in language from where they have continued to sort of previously be hawkish. They've maybe eased away from that slightly today with some sort of saying that we're moving towards a slightly more dovish stance. But really, I think that the big takeaway is that they're sort of unwilling to sort of move away and declare victory on inflation. They sort of reiterated that a hike sort of can't be ruled out. And I think that makes sense. If we take one look to the US, for example, if we look at their sort of inflation prints from January and February, it's telling us that last mile on inflation is still pretty difficult to crack. And I think that's why, you know, no central bank right now is in any rush to cut interest rates.
Michelle Bullock, the governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, takes to her feet in about 6 minutes' time. I'm sure you'll be watching with her press conference on this. She's relatively new to the job. Is she a hawk or a dove by nature?
Yeah, absolutely. She is very new to this, and this will be her sort of second meeting since we've sort of had this change of meeting setup where they sort of do have the statement after the decision. You know, so far since coming in, she has sort of taken that hawkish stance. I think it will be, though, pretty difficult for her to sort of remain, you know, in that sort of hawkish bias, really, because we've got economic growth disappointing in Australia. We've got inflation that we believe continues to cool. And we've got unemployment that is on an upward trend. So for us, it's going to be difficult for her to keep that hawkish bias moving forward. Again, we think that will stay intact today. But in the months ahead, we're going to get some really key sort of data points. And we think May is probably going to be the decision where she sort of starts to sort of move away from that hawkish tone.
Japan, first interest rate hike for 17 years. That was back in 2007. That was pre-Instagram. It's hard to imagine a world like that. Again, though, quite widely anticipated. Your thoughts?
Yeah, obviously, this is a highly significant move. As you say, first sort of move from the Bank of Japan or first hike since sort of 2007. I mean, look, it sort of is, you know, widely expected because we do have inflation that is gradually returning to Japan. We've got Japanese companies agreeing to sort of these large wage hikes as well. And I think that's going to boost expectations that we're going to start to see paychecks being spent by these households over the months ahead. So again, it is a huge decision. I think it will have, you know, broader impacts on the yen, on Japanese stocks. We haven't seen that so far because I think, you know, in the lead up to today, it was sort of very expected. But again, yeah, a huge decision. And I think it will ultimately, you know, have a big impact on the broader economy in Japan.
Right then, that's the big Asian ones done and dusted with for today. All eyes now turn to the United States. Fed meeting starts today. We get the decision at tomorrow night UAE time. We know that the Fed's going to keep rates on hold, but you're going to be watching comments from Jay Powell closely. And you think that the mood music might be that rates will stay. And I'm quoting you from a recent article you were quoted in saying higher for longer, Josh.
Yeah, I think that is the worry for investors, because we have seen that the last two inflation prints that we've got in the US have sort of showed that we're starting to see it stall slightly. And as I said a moment ago, that last mile on inflation certainly isn't easy. I think really markets are bracing for what is the dot plot, which is the expectations of rate cuts that we're going to get from those Federal Reserve members. We expect that to sort of come down again. I think markets are bracing for that. So we're likely to see this dot plot show three, going from three hikes down to two hikes. But I think it will really take something dramatic from Jerome Powell and the board today to unsettle, you know, the S&P 500 and US markets, because we've got these fundamental pillars in place that keep sending stocks back to record highs.
Bracing for the dot plot. I've written that one down, Josh. I'm stealing that one. In terms of the stock market in the United States, 30 seconds, you say that could put the brakes on what has been a very vibrant US stock market. Quick word on that.
Yeah, look, I think we may see some weakness in stocks because we've had such a huge run to start this year. We've had 15 or so record highs from the S&P 500. And I think that if we do get any weakness, because, you know, if we are going to see that, I think it goes without saying, we are going to get some weakness. But if we do get weakness, it will be bought up by investors because we do have rate cuts coming. And ultimately, we've got double-digit earnings growth from US companies this year. So I think any weakness will be bought up, and I think it will only be short-lived. And we see another good year for the S&P 500.
Can't let you go without a quick word on crypto. And it's not been a great few days for crypto. Bitcoin's down at $65,000. Now, it was approaching $75,000 a week ago. Can you read anything into this?
Yeah, look, I think it's just simply a huge run-up. We hit new record highs in the last sort of couple of weeks, you know, $72,000 for Bitcoin. You know, that to me just shows a bit of profit taking. Pretty much every person in the world that had bought Bitcoin up to that point, taking a little bit of profit on the table after a very, very long crypto winter. But also we're going into a very key period as well. This is a huge week of risk events on the macro front that always has the ability to impact crypto assets. So I think it's just a case of investors taking a little bit of risk off the table, given that this is a very highly volatile asset class, before such a big risk event this week. But I don't see it lasting for very long.
Josh, going to let you go. I know Michelle Bullock is doing her limbering up exercises as we speak ahead of that press conference for the Reserve Bank of Australia, not far from where you are now in Sydney, actually, in just a couple of minutes' time. Really appreciate your time on what is a very busy day for you. Josh Gilbert, market analyst at eToro in Sydney.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Sean Evers has joined us live in studio. Sean's the founder and the managing partner of Gulf Intelligence as we take our regular look at all things energy. Good morning to you, Mr. Evers.
Good morning, guys. Nice to be in the studio.
Good to have
Happy
you.
Happy Ramadan.
Yeah, Ramadan Kareem to you as well. And let's try and make sense of a few of these energy headlines that are, well, making headlines this morning. Let's start with the aforementioned oil price from Brandy there. Oil price climbing at the moment. Latest analysis saying what? Rise of about 2% to a four-month high in trade yesterday. Also, we're starting to see it sort of in and around that 86.5 barrel mark at the moment. What's driving this move in the markets at the moment?
Well, I think if you take a big picture view on the annual seasonality of oil demand, the second quarter is probably the peak oil demand, certainly in the West. And so the natural annual cycle, regardless of all the backdrop of geopolitical noise and refineries being attacked in Russia and so forth, is that there's just more demand in the second quarter. And if you keep everything else constant, then you're going to get a tighter market, because biggest demand call each year is the U.S. summer driving season, where all the Americans go on their holidays. They typically drive their cars from A to B. And so as a result, it's a very big demand window, and it pulls on what was a relatively, you know, well-supplied oil market in the first quarter. Second quarter is going to be naturally tighter if all things remain the same. So that's a big pull in itself. You add the geopolitical tensions in the background, actual infrastructure being attacked and knocked out, like the Russian refineries, and you can get an extra few dollars.
Are we going to see more volatility in the market? I mean, last time we had this conversation, you were talking about those barriers, you know, the 80 to 82 mark at the moment. We've sort of seen it break away from there. Are we going to see more volatility in the market? Which way do you read it at the moment?
I think we've broken out of that type, at least that would be my call on it, that sort of high 70s, low 80s band that we were in for, you know, most of the first quarter, although incrementally higher. It has to be remembered, we did start the year at $76 on Brent. So it was an incremental climb, but somewhat up and down, you know, high 70s, low 80s and back down again. This does look like a breakout. Certainly seasonality, it would be hard to see what would bring it down. As long as OPEC maintains its discipline on supply cuts, which will be critical in the second quarter. That's what makes the market tight, after all. If you keep 6-7 million barrels of oil supply capacity off the market, shut in, unavailable, and you go into a tighter demand period, prices only go up one way, you know. And with the geopolitical risk in the background, China is not as bad as people, the kind of mood music in the first quarter, oh, China's not really where it used to be, China is not great, there's kind of very bearish sentiment. As we go through the first quarter, we're realizing actually China is still decent, you know. It mightn't be thundering along, and everybody has to get their sort of revise their clock on China. Everybody's kind of still got a 8-9% growth mentality. This is a 3-5% growth economy now, and with that, you've got about 12 to 14 million barrels of oil a day imports. It's solid, so not great, but solid. So China's there. America's thumping along. I know Richard Dean's going to be upset, but there's going to be no interest rate cuts in America this year. The U.S. economy is barking. So you got that too, biggest oil consumer in the world.
Daily, right to reply there?
No, look, sure, I would like to see interest rates cut in the United States, but there's a growing core, as I heard Larry Summers say something similar last week in an interview. Don't be surprised if the Fed doesn't cut at all this week, because the US economy is
certainly
doing
not
very
this
well.
Week.
This year. So Sean Evers, as ever, is in good company.
Just whilst I've got you on the mic there, Deanie, one of the headlines that you picked up on a little bit earlier on today, I mean, Sean, they're talking about the fact that the market and the price for oil is solid at the moment. If ever they needed a sort of bold spokesperson for that market, I think we've got one, haven't we, overnight?
This is Amin Nasser. He's the CEO of Saudi Aramco, world's biggest oil company. Some days of the week, it's the world's biggest company, full stop. And he said last night, it is a fantasy to think of phasing out oil and gas. Brandy, you and I were joking about this earlier on, and your phrase was what?
He's in Texas.
Think it, don't say it, Amin.
Well, there was that. That probably was an inside thought. Mind you, pick your audience. If you are going to say it, Texas would be where you'd say it, wouldn't it?
Sean, you've been there, done that at that conference as well. Your reaction to those comments?
Well, of course. I mean, he's not going to say the opposite, obviously. I mean, you have to recognize, for right or wrong, that the oil industry, the oil and gas industry, has really got its mojo back after coming out. I mean, if you go two COPs back, coming out of Glasgow 26 COP, the oil and gas industry was really on the back foot. Energy security was nowhere in the headlines. Suddenly Russia invades Ukraine, and the only thing you've heard of for the last 2 years is energy security. And with that, a very, very boisterous and overconfident oil and gas industry, and as you know, they're pulling a little bit back from all their energy transition commitments, especially BP and Shell. So this is a very confident oil industry at the moment. Hopefully we won't get too much hubris, and we'll recognize that everything needs to coexist.
One of the other, speaking of coexisting, comments that we've picked up on from what Mr. Nasser said on stage is when he's talking about new energy sources, saying we should phase in new energy sources and technologies when they are genuinely ready, economically competitive, and with the right infrastructure. We were asking this morning, don't these things need to be given a go still in the nascent stage, or else not much would get done?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at Tesla. Elon Musk got $500 million from the U.S. government to start Tesla. Everybody forgets that the U.S. government started the internet. You know, obviously, lots of great technologies need encouragement, need support. And we have seen the renewables get support, subsidy or otherwise. Ironically, would you believe it, the oil industry still gets U.S. government subsidy every year, which is sort of a bit weird, but it does.
Well, the irony also is that the people who've got the money that can get this stuff off the ground when it's not economically competitive is in many ways the energy industry.
Talking of the energy industry, one other story I just want to get your thoughts on. Big one. It's gone under the radar a little bit here, I suppose, given what's going on over in Houston and elsewhere. Abu Dhabi's ADNOC signing this 15-year deal to supply gas to Germany. LNG deal as well. Reaction to that?
Listen, this is obviously good news all round. I mean, the other details in that deal is that it's to be powered by green power. So it would be green LNG, if you like. So from a German point of view, that ticks a lot of boxes. It may also mean it's a bit pricier. There's more of a premium to pay. But one has to note that also that the ADNOC has not signed off on the final commitment to build this LNG export facility in Ruwais. It's going through the motion. It's going through all of the phases. So this is a conditional contract. But nonetheless, it's very positive to see ADNOC and Abu Dhabi participate in the global LNG market more than they have in the past. And also green LNG, I think, is a real bonus.
Sean, always a pleasure, never a chore. Big thanks to you for joining us live on the show this morning. Sean Evers is the founder and the managing partner of Gulf Intelligence, joining us live on The Business Breakfast.
Catch up on the business headlines with The Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Here on The Business Breakfast, we love to take a couple of stories, string them together, and call them a trend. And in the last week or so, we've seen ADQ looking to develop a $35 billion project in Egypt on the Mediterranean coast. We've got Alibaba's Eagle Hills looking to build a whole new district, a whole new suburb in Budapest in Hungary. And it wasn't that long ago we were speaking to Jonathan Emery over at Aldar about the fact that they'd gone out and acquired a UK developer, London Square. To find out why we've got this drive in UAE property companies looking to develop overseas, very pleased to be joined by Taima Khan, who is Regional Head of Research at CBRE. Taima, good morning. Nice to speak to you.
Good morning, Brandy.
Look, I know it's not new. We've had developers such as MAF moving into Oman and Lebanon, Emaar into Saudi. But in terms of the numbers attached to some of these projects, it's been a big week. Why are UAE developers looking overseas?
I think it's a variety of reasons that we're seeing this. As you say, it's quite a number have happened over the few weeks. We've seen Eagle Hills into Bahrain as well, the deal into Egypt, and Aldar buying London Square as well. I think, first of all, it sort of speaks volumes about the value and the brand value that these UAE brands have built up, and the what they feel they can export to these other markets where there are quite considerable opportunities. And they the UAE is a very international market in terms of the investment volumes that come into this market. And I think having those customers and then providing that quality, that level of service, that product, they can feel that they can cross-sell it to those individuals as well.
Is it also a form of hedging against the market here?
I think to a degree. I think, of course, to the broader region, there's a lot of real estate investment happening within the GCC countries. So I think that would be sensible as well to diversify the revenue streams from the local market, and particularly into a number of international currencies where they are relatively stable. I think that helps as well.
What does it say also about what companies have available to them here in Dubai in particular in terms of land banks, particularly when it comes to mega projects and master communities?
I don't think it says too much. I think there's still reasonable land banks available. There's strategic projects which are happening, which there are numerous opportunities, whether you're the master developer there or you want to do a joint venture with that master developer. I think the thing that we have seen is the lack of prime land is becoming a bit more acute now, although we will see some new lands unlocked across the coastline, of course, as part of Dubai 2040. But I don't think it says too much about that. I think it's more about the opportunities which exist within these other markets and actually to leverage off the great success stories that we've had with whether it's Aldar historically with Emaar or the likes of Eagle Hills.
Do you lose the home mover or the home builder advantage, though? I mean, what are the challenges of trying to do what you're doing here overseas?
I think it is certainly challenging when you're going into some of these new markets. And I think, some of the ways of overcoming those challenges is looking at sort of taking undertaking the types of transactions which ALDA are paired out, for example. So you've got local expertise within existing brand there that you can utilize, and you know, utilize this balance sheet strength of a very large entity in the likes of ALDA. But I think if you look at how these markets operate as well, they are slightly different. Home ownership rates in some of these countries are significantly higher than what we have here. How they finance and those individuals within those countries, how they finance and purchase those homes is different as well. So I think there will be a learning curve in certain occasions, but I think, like I said, the opportunities are actually incredibly significant within these markets.
You mentioned ALDA there, and yes, they've not tried to start building in London themselves. They have acquired a developer. Is that the easier, softer way in terms of everything from, I don't know, staffing to legislation?
I think it definitely, you know, would be very helpful where you have an existing structure that you are able to utilize and that effectively allows you to provide sort of an accelerated route to market. And we've seen that happen into Egypt as well. So I think it's certainly very helpful. And then you have the strength of someone like ALDA's balance sheet to be able to utilize, in particularly in markets now, which are, in certain markets, the use of the credit market and the funding historically has been significant. And given where interest rates are, that's a huge, added benefit to be able to actually go to market a lot quicker and rather than have to rely on debt funding.
Very quickly, Tamer, at the same time, I'm told that the reason we're seeing a lot of new development names on hoardings at the moment is because a lot of European developers particularly are looking at lack of scope in their home markets and therefore are moving here, or at least putting some money in the ground here. How do both work at the same time?
We are certainly seeing that at CBRE. We're working with a number of international developers who are looking to enter the market, whether it's built to sell or built to rent. And they, in their own right, for example, in the built to rent side of things, feel that they have considerable operating experience in how to, you know, build out those portfolios and create a very different type of institutional product. So they can come into the market. And their return profiles are different as well. So I think... like I said, there's a considerable amount of opportunity, and the market's matured where, you know, there are now joint venture opportunities which these developers can enter into as well. And mm-hmm. once again, some of these are very significant brands who are coming into the market and they feel that they can leverage on that as well.
Tamer Khan, Regional Head of Research for CBRE, thank you so much for joining us on the Business Breakfast this morning.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.